Well, as I think this weekend demonstrates, IJ takes on big fights with big opponents and where the stakes are hugely consequential for our clients and thousands of other people like them. Even when one individual case might seem local and on a smaller scale, it's all tied into a strategic plan to establish precedent and to raise the profile of the causes we champion. As you heard, we continue to push long-standing campaigns such as economic liberty and civil forfeiture, accelerate recently launched projects, and explore cutting-edge and important new areas for us to become involved, like the panel you just heard. I wanted to spend the remainder of our time together this afternoon before we go into the Q&A sessions and our big dinner celebration this evening, along with a break between then, too, to give you a little bit of a flavor of what is coming down the pike for IJ, the shape of justice to come. But before offering some broader thinking on our issue areas and strategy, I just want to talk briefly about some internal items we're doing to continue to move IJ into a bright and productive future. You know, in my talk yesterday, I spoke about IJ's explosive growth in the past few years. Not surprisingly, we have had to expand our office footprint, both at IJ HQ and in our state offices. And as you might be curious to know about how we're handling office work in the wake of the pandemic, we are keeping an in-office component to the work at IJ. We feel like that is just so important to a mission-driven organization and very important to maintaining a vibrant IJ culture. Indeed, at a time when many nonprofit and for-profit places are reducing their office footprint or even closing them entirely, before the end of this year, we will now have a total of 2 full floors at IJ HQ with a total of 58,000 square feet there. And we welcome you to come and visit anytime you happen to be in the DC area. We have just a wonderfully designed office that really captures the spirit of IJ, a lot of fun displays there, so you are always more than welcome to come by. Let me tell you, it was an excellent time to negotiate with commercial landlords, as Dan Knepper, our CFO, will tell you, and he did a terrific job getting us very favorable terms for this. We also secured new office space for most of our state offices as well. In fact, our brand new office space in the ever fast expanding Austin, Texas, and our state office there is close to 7,000 square feet, which was about the size of IJ's second headquarters before we moved to our current space in Arlington. As you saw from many of the presenters this weekend, IJ continues to attract incredibly talented people who want to make their careers at IJ. Lawyers, but also researchers, development professionals, legislative specialists, grassroots activists, and communications staff. All of these IJers could be making significantly more money in the private sector, but they are determined to leave their mark on the law and the fight for individual liberty. You have witnessed some of them in action this weekend, but we have many more back in HQ and in our state offices. I want to talk a little bit to you and inform you a little bit about our work to defend and expand educational choice, which is going to be the subject of tonight's dinner. As you all know, interest in educational choice has never been higher, especially in the wake of the utter frustration with the public schools during and after the pandemic. It's an exciting time in the history of the movement for choice. Since the pandemic, 24 states have enacted new or expanded choice programs. And some of those states, such as West Virginia, Arizona, and now North Carolina, have passed universal programs, the true Friedman vision, eventually reaching all or most families within the state. We are taking full advantage of this moment. Alongside this exciting period, though, IJ's work in this area will change over the course of the next few years. As you'll be hearing more about tonight, IJ has been in court every single day since our founding, defending choice, defending the constitutionality of choice from attack. And when IJ was founded in 1991, the constitutionality of choice was very much in doubt. Over the course of three decades, we have successfully defended 22 choice programs. And during that same period, we have systematically established the constitutionality of choice and have taken away weapon after weapon that the teachers' unions use to try to stop these programs. With our Supreme Court victory in the Carson case from Maine last summer, IJ has finally resolved the last major federal constitutional question concerning educational choice. We have also resolved several major state constitutional questions over the past decades. In the wake of Carson, choice programs are still being challenged, but the nature of those challenges is changing. The attacks are increasingly coming under narrower, more obscure provisions of state constitutions and statutes. And the issues at stake are often specific to only one state, with no broader national implications. For instance, a recent challenge to the New Hampshire program turned on the statutory minutiae of whether state lottery funds could be used to fund choice programs. In contrast, and as we've been talking about all weekend, IJ has always been about tackling big constitutional questions with broad national import. And that's just not really the direction that educational choice litigation is headed. It's important for organizations like IJ to declare victory in certain areas where we feel like our goals have been achieved. We believe we are close to that moment with Ed Choice. So tonight's dinner, we are going to celebrate everything we've achieved for parents and kids since IJ's founding. So what does this mean for the future of our work in the education space? In the near term, again, we want to take advantage of this moment of exciting growth in educational choice. So we will still actively advise state legislators and our allies on crafting constitutionally sound programs. And we will continue to defend many of these programs in court, especially those that are universal in nature. Even as we work to ensure that the mantle of defending choice programs from attack is successfully transitioned. And look for more details about that in the months ahead. I want to give you at least a little flavor, though, of some of the other type of work we will likely do in education in the years ahead. Over the last several years, and especially since the pandemic, parents and education entrepreneurs have been developing new and exciting models of education, such as learning pods, micro schools, homeschool co-ops, and more. These were once unfamiliar ideas, but now they enjoy widespread popularity as parents and students seek creative ways to deliver education outside of the government school system. In response, the government has been doing what government usually does when faced with change in entrepreneurship by the private sector, shoehorning these new models into old regulations that don't allow for innovation or imposing new regulations that stifle ingenuity. In response, IJ will champion and defend innovative new forms of education. We have always pushed to ensure that educational choice programs can offer the largest possible range of options for parents. Now we will make those options as broad as possible on behalf of those who want to explore new private methods of educating kids. Currently, we are examining the barriers education entrepreneurs and parents face, from zoning boards to school district policies to state accreditation laws. These restrictions impact a parent's right to direct the education of their child, along with additional rights that are central to IJ's mission, such as rights to free speech and association, economic liberty, and private property. We will explore and, where appropriate, take on cutting-edge major constitutional issues in this field, and I look forward to reporting to you on the results of our work in the years ahead. So in addition to these exciting new areas we'll explore in the education field, we'll also become more deeply involved in some of the issues that you've heard talked about this weekend. You heard about two of our most recent projects, the project on immunity and accountability we launched in 2020, and the project on the Fourth Amendment we launched the following year. Both projects build upon and expand work IJ has been doing for years, but they take us into vitally important and yet largely uncharted waters. We are literally making the law on immunity and accountability as we speak. So far, there have been many ups and downs and challenges like there have been in every area in which we've litigated. But we are setting the terms of the debate and quickly becoming the go-to experts and lawyers in this field. We launched our Fourth Amendment project largely because of the opportunity we saw to make a real difference in the law on our terms. Other organizations that used to focus in this area, like the ACLU, have reduced their role. They have other priorities, largely in the political realm, that they want to focus on, creating an opportunity for strategic public interest litigation, which is needed more now than ever. Moreover, the courts have been recognizing to a greater degree that Fourth Amendment rights are founded upon property rights, always a key pillar of IJ's work. So as you've heard, we've stepped into the breach, building upon the Fourth Amendment work we've been doing for years while expanding it into new and important areas. With both of these projects, we're really just getting warmed up. So look for IJ to expand our work on challenging unreasonable zoning practices that led to the housing crisis we see playing out in state after state. You know, one of the most prominent classical liberal legal scholars today, our friend Professor Ilya Soman at George Mason Law, has labeled the fight against exclusionary zoning the most important property rights issue of today. And IJ will be right in the middle of that fight. Likewise, IJ will expand some of the work that we're doing on other cutting-edge property rights issues you heard about this weekend, like challenging unlawful evictions by the government and the incredibly creepy and dystopian practice of predictive policing. IJ has increasingly become involved in cases involving healthcare. As we all know, healthcare is in desperate need of market forces and injection of competition. And many of our current challenges to certificate of need laws, along with licensing requirements for expanding practices like telemedicine, go toward removing antiquated barriers to how healthcare is provided. Likewise, we are doing more cases concerning the ability of individuals to have more say over decisions regarding their own health. Governments like to limit people's access to information about their health, limiting, for instance, self-diagnostic tools. So look for our involvement to expand in that area also in the years ahead. You recall Dana's compelling presentation on the perverse financial incentives that exist in so many areas of the law today. We will expand our work challenging those schemes, including the types of claims that we bring under federal and state constitutions. You know, one area we didn't even have a chance to discuss this weekend because we have so many things that we want to talk about is challenging the administrative state. The U.S. Supreme Court currently has an interest in this area, and we are, again, taking advantage of that interest. We currently have three cases challenging the administrative state, and including the fact that defendants in cases brought by powerful administrative agencies don't get before a real judge, nor do they have access to a jury, even though they may face crippling and excessive fines. When we do cases in this area, we will continue to make sure that they are done the IJ way, in that we will always represent individuals or small entrepreneurs, not large corporations, and we will continue to bring claims that line up with other issues and areas in which IJ litigates. So, turning away from our current and new areas, you will also see in the months ahead a slightly different orientation in the way that we talk about IJ and our mission. I want to say at the outset, we will continue to emphasize core IJ principles that have remained a part of IJ since our founding, and we will continue to make everyday people the focus of our work. As you know, IJ has always excelled at putting a human face on the issues that we champion and highlighting the type of people we represent, everyday people, often lower income or working class, non-establishment individuals who are simply trying to live their lives but who are being met with overreaching, often abusive exercises of power by those in authority. Those are the type of people we've long represented and will always do so. We'll make clear that our mission is to dismantle barriers to opportunity, let people pursue their dreams as they see fit, unleashing their creativity and entrepreneurial spirit. In the same way we herald what we champion, like expanding freedom and taking down barriers, we will make clear what we challenge, abuses of power by those in authority. We'll make it even more clear in our work that we will hold government officials accountable when they do abuse their power. Looking forward, we're going to be even more direct in our mission and our public statements that IJ works apart from partisan politics. As I noted yesterday, in today's often tribal political environment, it's never been more important to stress our nonpartisan nature. Now, nonpartisan, of course, does not mean non-principled or me trying to push IJ into some sort of squishy or moderate center. We will always remain committed to our core principles of a passionate belief in freedom and free markets, open inquiry, pluralism, and the rule of law. But by standing outside of partisan politics and working with a broad range of individuals and groups across the ideological spectrum, we will remain committed solely to our principles and never beholden to any party, political movement, or perhaps most importantly, political figure. Where you also see a shift is that the Institute for Justice is going to lean more into the justice part of our name. We are going to rededicate ourselves to that word. It's in our title, after all, and as you might perhaps not coincidentally see it on stage here with us throughout the weekend. We will talk more directly about how IJ advances justice. You might recall, justice is actually in the first long phrase of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, which declares that we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. It's the second thing listed. Justice has the advantage of being broadly accepted by people of all stripes, even if they might disagree with what exactly it means. Emphasizing justice will be particularly helpful in introducing people to IJ. Now, rest assured, this focus on justice won't replace our commitment to freedom and individual liberty, and the name of our flagship publication, Liberty and Law, will remain the same. Instead, we will intentionally balance our use of words that have long been a part of our vocabulary with this key word, justice, which is the foundation of our name. Now, as you know, most classical liberal thinkers through the years have emphasized the importance of individual liberty, but just as many has likewise championed justice as an essential component of a free society. Indeed, justice is directly linked to both liberty and to another essential liberal value, that of the rule of law. In one of the most well-known passages from The Wealth of Nations, the great classical liberal Adam Smith linked liberty and the ability to pursue one's own interests to justice. He wrote, "Every man, as long as he does not violate the laws of justice, is left perfectly free to pursue his own interests his own way." The later liberal economist Henry Hazlitt of Economics in One Lesson fame likewise championed justice by noting its relation to individual freedom and how it also furthers the voluntary and peaceful exchange among individuals. Hazlitt wrote, "Justice itself consists in observance of the rules or principles that do most in the long run to preserve and promote social cooperation." And we will use justice without qualifiers. We will not support, for instance, outcome determinative or redistributive justice, which is sometimes called social justice. Indeed, the great liberal F.A. Hayek, in his defense of the free society, law, legislation, and liberty, named the second volume of that the Mirage of Social Justice. As Hayek and others noted, it is essential to the rule of law that general rules of justice be applied equally and without arbitrary exceptions. Now, the flip side of justice is, of course, injustice. And that is also something we will highlight more in our rhetoric and approach. You might have noticed that we included on the back of side of our beautiful holiday card last year a stirring quote from Martin Luther King Jr. from his letter from a Birmingham jail. "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Likewise, the great classical liberal thinker John Stuart Mill said that the most marked cases of injustice are acts of wrongful aggression, or wrongful exercise of power over someone. The next are those which consist in wrongfully withholding from someone something which is his due. That sounds a lot like IJ cases and clients. We challenge the injustice of wrongful aggression and the wrongful exercise of power over someone. And we challenge wrongfully withholding from someone, something which is his or her due. Whether it's Norma trying to feed the homeless in Arizona, Chastity trying to live her life in her tiny home in Idaho, Mark trying to provide needed services to the sick and elderly in Nebraska, Kendra, who you'll hear from tonight, trying to get a quality education for her kids in Montana, Sylvia fighting against abuse and lack of accountability in Castle Hills, Rebecca fighting against two incredibly powerful federal law enforcement agencies, or some of the other close to 200 clients we currently represent who are with us here in person or in spirit this weekend. Thank you for being a key partner in our work to advance freedom and justice for all Americans. Count on IJ.
Thank you.
Count on IJ to remain steadfast in the dedication and resolve we bring to all of our work, and I look forward to keeping you apprised of the results we achieve. To close these remarks, I will once again quote the great Tom Paine in saying that IJ's work will consist of doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. Unless, of course, if they might work for the government. Thank you all.